Welcome back for Hour 2 of Issues, Etc. We're taking up the topic that is, of course, the topic of the day and the news of the day, the capture of Saddam Hussein. And now that we've got him, what do we do with him? We'll be talking about that with international human rights attorney Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. But now, before we talk to Dr. Montgomery, our Issues, Etc. book of the month for December is St. Nicholas, The Real Story of the Christmas Legend. This is a children's book. You can order it for your kids or your grandkids. It tells the real story of this 4th century bishop in Turkey and how he both preached Christ and gave gifts. It's the real story. Now, today, December 15th, we're only 10 days out from Christmas, but more than that, this is the last day that you can order this book if you want to receive it by Christmas without paying for express shipping. Today, the 15th. So, call Concordia Publishing House in the next hour here during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, and order our Issues, Etc. book of the month for December, St. Nicholas. You can also browse before you buy, and if you're willing to pay a little extra for shipping, wait a day or two, and see what the book is all about at our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You'll find information on St. Nicholas there. You can visit one of Concordia Publishing House's two locations here in St. Louis, one here in Clayton on the campus of Concordia Seminary, the other at 3558 South Jefferson. That's at the corner of Miami and Jefferson in St. Louis. When you go in, when you write, when you call, mention Issues, Etc. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is Professor Emeritus at the University of Luton in England. He's a French advocate, a barrister at law in England and Wales, and a member of the Bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He's the Distinguished Professor of Apologetics and the History of Christian Thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana. He's author and editor of more than 50 books, including Christians in the Public Square. He's also our Issues, Etc. legal affairs correspondent. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, welcome back.
Thank you so much.
Hey, how does that last? How does that last job there, our legal correspondent? How does that pay?
Doesn't pay at all. It's very much like my emeritus position at the University of Luton. They get credit for all my research, and they don't pay me anything. It's a wonderful arrangement for the university, and I think it says a lot for Issues, Etc., that they've been able to manage the same sort of thing.
It's great. I love taking credit for all of your wisdom. It's marvelous. It's amazing how often, Dr. Montgomery, someone will say, boy, I heard what you said, thus and so is brilliant, and it turns out to be something you said. I'm just asking the questions.
And, of course, you always footnote me, don't you?
Every time.
Every time.
Every time. Dr. Montgomery, your reaction to the capture of Saddam Hussein yesterday?
Well, it was great news, of course. And it was particularly fascinating over here to see that even in those countries such as Germany and France that had opposed the coalition's going in, everyone was saying, oh, what a wonderful thing, that hideous dictator has been captured. Well, if he was that hideous a dictator, then why did they stay on the sidelines and not do anything about it? It reminded me a bit of Switzerland during the Second World War. Of course, the Swiss had certain special reasons for staying neutral, but I think that Germany and France made a terrible mistake on a issue of great moral importance in not doing anything about Saddam at all.
And since we're on that subject for just a second, there has been quite a flap over the Bush administration and the provisional government there in Iraq refusing places in bidding for contracts for the rebuilding of Iraq to those countries that refused to give us any help and in some ways actually stood in our way, in particular Germany and France. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm a Francophile, of course, and we live in France part of every year, but I think that the U.S. government has every right to exclude them from bidding in these areas, or the Iraqi government's refusing to let them do so. The fact of the matter is that if one stands aside on a serious moral issue and other people take up the burden, then there's no reason at all for the countries that did stay on the side to benefit in any way from this.
Let's start generally and work our way toward the specific, Dr. Montgomery. Who should try Saddam Hussein for the crimes he has committed?
Well, there are two theories on this, of course. The one is that he should be tried by his own people. he should be tried in Iraq. The other theory is that he should be tried internationally. Now, the argument for his being tried in Iraq is, of course, that then the people that he persecuted, the people who have suffered the most, will be in a position to deal with the appropriate punishment, prepare the appropriate punishment for him. The problem with this is that Iraq has had a whole generation without civil liberties and an established court system. And this means that they are really in a very weak position to know how to handle this properly. The thing could so easily become a kangaroo court where the end result was known from the beginning, a fait accompli, and therefore the whole thing could turn around and bite them. The argument for an international tribunal doing this, a tribunal such as the War Crimes Tribunal in the Netherlands, is that they are a sophisticated operation which has already had a good deal of experience in dealing with the problems in Eastern Europe, and therefore the chances of getting a proper kind of result are much greater under those circumstances. Also, this could remove a lot of ugly criticism that that really the Iraqi situation is just a clone of the U.S. And coalition operation that goes on there at the present time. If this took place in The Hague, there would be no possibility of arguing that way. And apparently the evidence is so overwhelming against Saddam, including the war crimes and atrocities aspect of it as a result of his gassing Kurds, that he would most certainly be condemned in that context. Of course, there would not be a death penalty under those circumstances, because the European countries are firmly opposed to the death penalty under any and all circumstances. If he were tried in Iraq, he could very well be executed. But it seems to me that there are worse things than execution, and what we have to do is to see this thing in a larger perspective. So I would favor, certainly, that he be tried in an international tribunal and not in Iraq itself.
Now, I guess this raises a question. Yesterday, the press release said that the United States, at the very least, is considering Saddam Hussein a prisoner of war. What is his status at this point? Is he an enemy combatant, a prisoner of war, a breaker of Iraqi laws or of international laws? How do you describe his status?
Well, the easiest way to understand it is to regard him as a prisoner of war. A war very definitely took place, and he was the leader of the country, and he was put on a most wanted list, and therefore is in that position. But of course, a prisoner of war is in a limbo. He really is being held pending charges to be brought against him, and the situation prior to the Second World War was that there wasn't any international tribunal available to deal with situations like that. So that prior to the Second World War, when a war ended, either the victors simply eliminated those who had caused the problem insofar as they were able to do this, or those people went free. You know, at the end of the First World War, for example, the Kaiser was not imprisoned. With the end of the Second World War and the atrocities that had taken place as a result of the Nazi regime, you had the Nuremberg war crimes trial procedure set up, and you had a similar situation in Japan. And those tribunals were set up on the basis of what is known as the International Military Tribunal. This was simply a committee of the victors, but the committee endeavored to employ international law as a basis for judging those who had committed the crimes. And therefore, one would assume that Saddam will remain in this limbo state, prisoner of war, whatever you want to call it, until such time as it's decided whether he should be subjected to an international tribunal or given over to his own people.
Saddam Hussein, of course, has joined the ranks of former dictators now, along with the likes of Pol Pot and Slobodan Milosevic and Augusto Pinochet and many others, the warlords in Rwanda. Some of these men are being brought to justice. Some of them will never be brought to justice in any real and objective sense. What structures now exist and procedures are in place if, for instance, it was finally decided that Saddam Hussein, Iraq simply can't put together a court system in a timely fashion, and Saddam Hussein needs to be tried for the crimes, therefore he goes before an international tribunal?
Well, the appropriate tribunal, as we've said, is the one in the Netherlands that has tried people from the former Yugoslavia who were involved in atrocities, particularly among the Muslim population, et cetera. So that would be the appropriate location, and it would simply be a matter of an indictment being brought, which would be brought presumably by the Iraqi, the present Iraqi leadership, or the United States. And then once the indictment comes down, then he is simply transported to The Hague, and he's held there as Milosevic has been held there, pending trial. So that would presumably be the way in which this would be handled. You're quite right that not all of these miseries that you've described can be handled by human tribunals. And I think that's very important. The atheist, the secularist, who says you don't need religion in order to handle problems of justice, doesn't seriously see that so many of the miseries of this world can't be taken care of in human tribunals. This is exactly why a last judgment is essential if you ever want to have a moral and ethical result for the universe as a whole. You've got to have this. You've got to have a God who is a God of perfect justice, and you've got to have his assurance that there will be a last assize, there will be a final judgment, and the things that are done in secret will be shouted to the housetops. It's at a point like that Christians can have an incredibly great advantage over the secularist.
Seems as though there are really two questions here. One is, now that we have him, what do we do with him? But the more pressing question, more immediate question might be, who gets to decide what we do with him? Do we have precedent for this?
Not really. The de facto, the decision will certainly be made by the coalition forces. That means by the governments involved in the successful war. And of course, the U.S. will have the primary role in that regard. That doesn't worry me. I don't even get worried about the notion of the U.S. as an international policeman, because in spite of all the problems in the U.S., the fact is that the U.S. is deeply penetrated by a biblical morality, and we're very fortunate to have a president who, even though his rhetoric could stand some improvement, is a serious Christian believer, and I firmly am convinced that the U.S. decision as to what will be done will be in the best interests of everyone. I think that the U.S. is very concerned that when he is tried, not only will justice be done, but justice will be seen to be done. The only mistake, in my opinion, that the U.S. and Britain made in this conflict was to give the wrong reason for doing it, or to give a minor reason instead of the major reason. The existence of hidden weaponry was a trivial point. The real point was that this miserable man had created a damnable system that had virtually destroyed his country and brought about the death and the maiming of hundreds and thousands of people. When a person like that operates, they've got to be dealt with. You can't stand on the sidelines and say, well, after all, it's an internal problem. Let the country deal with it itself. It was that kind of an attitude before the Second World War on the part of the British Prime Minister Chamberlain that simply turned whole areas of Europe over to Hitler. Evil like that has got to be opposed, and there's no sense in apologizing for it. You simply state that you're doing this, and then you let the devil take the hindmost.
We're talking with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery about international human rights and the capture of Saddam Hussein. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is an international human rights lawyer. Dr. Montgomery, I received an email from my brother, who's actually serving in Iraq, right there on one of the western on the western point of the Sunni Triangle, as a captain in the reserves, and he talked about the kind of the general reaction of the troops over there. But he said key in this is honoring the sensibilities of the Arab culture. They have different sensibilities about justice, the swiftness of justice, the nature of justice, and we cannot ignore those things regardless of what we do with Saddam Hussein. Would you concur?
Yes, I would. At the same time, we mustn't pander to Near Eastern interests without any regard to the larger world situation. It doesn't seem to be this has to be a problem. If we recognize that there are those special concerns in the Near East, we should be able to take them into account. But I think in the long run, if, let us say, in terms of the very, very severe, and I would say an unfortunate emphasis in Islam on physical punishment and that kind of thing, if we should come to the conclusion that only maiming him or torturing him or executing him would make certain countries in the Near East happy, we should still not do it. What we need to do is to make sure that the historical record on this kind of thing demonstrates that he has been given a fair trial. There has been an opportunity for him to defend himself. He has been able to face the evidence and offer whatever explanations that he has, and in spite of that, the judgment has come down against him. I mean, that's the sort of thing that can be a model for justice in similar situations in the future. And don't think that he's the only miserable dictator around engaging in activities of this kind. I mean, Mugabe in Zimbabwe is certainly on the level of Saddam Hussein. There's no question about this. And in my opinion, he should be eliminated as well. And I don't see, as I said, I don't see any problem whatsoever with the U.S. moving into situations of that kind. There is an ancient and solid doctrine of humanitarian intervention in international law. If you can't get international organizations to intervene, then it's perfectly all right for a country to do this for the sake of the poor victims of the kind of tyranny that's created.
I imagine there will be countries lining up, especially if we go back a decade to the first Gulf War. We've got Kuwait, who obviously could file a grievance against Saddam Hussein. There were Scuds launched into Israel. They could, I guess, in theory, also lodge a grievance. Then there are Turkish or Kurdish, I should say, tribes in the northern part of Iraq that never really bought into Saddam Hussein, who suffered greatly at his hand. The list goes on and on of people who bring charges.
Oh, yes. There's no question about this. The list of charges is going to be very, very long, and these reach the point of genocide and the kinds of human rights violations that have been already judged by the international tribunals. So it would be a very strange thing to me if Saddam got out of this on any level whatsoever. I think it's a fait accompli, and I think he recognizes this himself. The only news reports that we've seen on this have presented the the Iraqi leadership that interviewed him, and the Iraqi leadership said that he had no remorse whatsoever. He defended everything that he had done and didn't seem to have any feelings toward the Iraqi people at this point at all. And, of course, if he persists in that, there's no question as to what the result is going to be.
On the issue of who will try him and where he will be tried, is a combination possible? That is, an international tribunal that will allow the Iraqi people to be heavily represented, not only in the prosecution of the crimes, in the bringing of the charges, but also in the decision making.
Well, that's possible. At the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, the when a case is brought against a country, the judge on the court from that country always sits as one of the judges to make the decision. Now, the number of judges is seven or sometimes nine, so he could never have a deciding voice. But out of courtesy, he is allowed to sit. The problem in The Hague is that that Iraq doesn't have any judge there, and I suppose what they could do is to bring in, to allow the provisional Iraqi government to appoint a judge who would sit ex officio along with the judges that would normally handle a situation like this. That might be a possibility. It's also, I suppose, theoretically possible to have a kind of two-tiered system in which the Iraqis would have a court, and the court would reach a conclusion, but then that conclusion would be retried de novo in The Hague. Now, they've never done anything like that, but it would theoretically be possible. It would be clumsy because, of course, the same evidence would be presented two times. It would not be possible for the court in the Hague to become an appeals court for a national court. That would not work because these are two entirely different legal systems. So, you know, it's hard to say. It would, in my opinion, as I've already said, be far more desirable to have him tried internationally outside of Iraq, but perhaps the appointment of an Iraqi judge ex officio on the panel would help, would make the situation appear more to the liking of everybody.
Dr. Montgomery, I have a few more questions. Can you stay with us through this break for a few minutes?
Oh, sure. No problem.
Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is our guest. He is Professor Emeritus at the University of Luton in England, a French advocate, a barrister at law in England and Wales, a member of the Bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He's also a distinguished professor of apologetics and the history of Christian thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana, and he's author and editor of more than 50 books, including Christians in the Public Square. When we come back from this break, I'll ask him a little bit about this book, Christians in the Public Square, and I'll tell you how you can get a hold of it for yourself. Now, if you have a question or a comment, our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. When we come back, the gold standard of these things seems to be the Nuremberg precedent. We'll talk a little bit about what basic principles of international human rights and international justice were laid down there after the Second World War. Then Saddam Hussein as an information source, an independent issue from what should happen to him. What can we get out of him? Stay with us.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. Listening to Issues, Etc.
If you're a talk radio junkie like me, you might assume that the programming is free. Commercial advertisers pay for the production costs and staff salaries. Well, that's true for most talk radio shows, but not for Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is listener-supported. That means we rely on you to pay the production salaries and airtime costs for this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin asking you to prayerfully consider making a financial gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You can donate by credit card, 1-800-737-0172. Or you can donate by check, Issues, etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Remember, unlike other talk radio shows, Issues, etc. needs your financial support. We depend upon you for the continuation and expansion of Issues, etc.
Here's a message from the people of King of Kings Lutheran Church in Chesterfield, our AM 850 KFUO Church of the Week. If you're involved and cared for in a church family, praise God. If not, you're invited to worship Jesus, the King, at King of Kings Lutheran Church in Chesterfield. King of Kings is located at 13765 Olive Boulevard in Chesterfield. Services are at 8 o'clock and 10:45 with varied Bible studies at 9:30 each Sunday. At King of Kings, your care is our concern. For more information, call 314-469-2224.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. A man who owned thousands of slightly misspelled website addresses in a scam that diverted children to internet pornography is headed to prison. It's the first conviction under the Truth in Domain Names Act. Terry Phillips reports.
100 days after John Zuccherini's arrest, the U.S. attorney in southern New York had a guilty plea. Matt Lloyd is spokesman for Indiana Congressman Mike Pence, who authored the Domain Names Act.
Basically, it's a truth in advertising bill. We're making sure that criminals can't mislead young children.
The bill is designed to shut down those who rely on kids to slightly misspell popular web addresses like Teletubbies or Disneyland. It grew out of a homework session.
Congressman Pence was helping his daughter type in some domain names, and they actually misspelled the name of a website and it took him to a pornographic site.
Zuccherini's operation netted him as much as $1 million annually. His guilty plea on no less than 49 counts is the result of a plea bargain. Daniel Weiss of Focus on the Family is disappointed about the sentence Zuccherini will likely receive.
For all the harm this man has caused, it's a little unsettling that he's only going to spend about 3 years in prison.
Nonetheless, Weiss applauds the fact that Zuccherini's operation is now shut down.
This is a good first step, but we need to see more steps, and they need to happen fairly quickly, considering how much fraud and internet scamming is going on.
Zuccherini owned 3,000 misspelled website names. For Family News and Focus, I'm Terry Phillips.
The rest of the math goes this way. Every time Zuccherini misdirected someone to a porn site, he received a dime to 25 cents. It's unclear whether he'll have to make any financial restitution, but each of the 49 counts could have carried a $250,000 fine. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Issues, etc. and Concordia Publishing House are excited about our book of the month for December, St. Nicholas, The Real Story of the Christmas Legend. It's the perfect Christmas gift for your young child or grandchild. St. Nicholas is published by Concordia Publishing House. 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about this new children's book at issuesetc.org. Click the What's New section, issuesetc.org.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. Now, we're talking about the international human rights issue, especially as it pertains to the capture of Saddam Hussein. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. If you have a question or a comment on international human rights and the capture of Saddam Hussein, give us a call right now, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our guest, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, in addition to being, and we very proudly say, a regular guest here on Issues, Etc., he's also an international human rights attorney, and he's author and editor of more than 50 books, including Christians in the Public Square. Dr. Montgomery, before we go to the phones, tell us a little bit about this, your work, Christians in the Public Square.
Well, this collects the essays that I've done over the years on public issues, issues where, in my opinion, there ought to be a theological understanding, a theological perspective. And the book contains, oh, goodness, probably 40 relatively short essays dealing with issues that are of particular consequence. The program that we are now on is called Issues, Etc., and that's exactly the kind of thing that this book contains. So people who like to work on matters such as abortion, euthanasia, the death penalty, the relationship between democracy and Christianity, that sort of thing would certainly enjoy the book.
Folks, let me just say, having read that book several times, if you're looking for something that just doesn't offer ideas or opinions, but in fact gives you a solid basis, in fact, for deciding issues like the kinds that Dr. Montgomery has laid out for us, and a solid way of thinking about them as well, you can't do better than this book, Christians in the Public Square. You can purchase it by calling the Canadian Institute for Law, Theology, and Public Policy. Here's their number, area code 780-461-3076. That's 780 area code 461-3076. Or you can find out more about this book on the web at CILTPP.com. Here it is again, CILTPP.com. As I said before, I invite your questions and your comments on human rights and the capture of Saddam Hussein, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Up first, Matt is calling from Richmond Heights. Matt, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd. Since we're talking about international intervention, in particular U.S. intervention in Iraq, my question concerns the reverse. I'd like to ask Dr. Montgomery about the apparent new focus of some U.S. Supreme Court justices on applying international legal precedent and case law domestically. Since I believe in American sovereignty, shouldn't we be quite alarmed at this prospect that these American judges would be using international law and applying it domestically?
Thank you very much, Matt. And I think the particular case, Dr. Montgomery, has to do with the so-called Lawrence v. Texas case, in which the Supreme Court did, at the very least, make mention of European law there. What are your thoughts?
Well, it's very interesting to me that there are so many evangelical Christians who regard national sovereignty as a kind of revealed principle. Actually, you will not find national sovereignty set forth as a revelatory principle anywhere in Scripture. What Scripture sets forth is an absolute standard of morality, of ethics. So, if evangelical Christians were really consistent, what they would do is to ask both about international and domestic law whether it accords with God's will. And where international law does not accord with God's will and domestic law does, obviously we would not employ the international law. But since all have sinned and come short of the glory of God, and this will come as a tremendous shock, that includes Americans. Since Americans have sinned, and the laws in America are the product of sinful Americans, you are going to find instances where American law is deficient. And there are instances where international law is far superior to American law. And where that is the case, then one would certainly expect the judge to employ the international law insofar as he's able to do so within the constitutional constraints that exist in the United States. I give you a very concrete example of this. The Inter-American or American Convention on Human Rights protects the rights of human beings, quote, in general from the moment of conception, unquote. In other words, the American Convention on Human Rights says that human beings exist from the moment of conception. The reason why the U.S. has not ratified the American Convention on Human Rights is because if America had ratified it, then the U.S. could be brought before the Inter-American Court of Human Rights in Costa Rica for having violated the right to life. In America, there is abortion on demand, and the abortion on demand is the product of American law, and it happens to be the product of a ghastly, sinful kind of law which should be eliminated. So, in answer to the person's question, why don't you stop being a national sovereigntist and instead turn out to be a biblical Christian and judge all law by God's standards?
I'd like to hear from the rest of you as well on international human rights and the capture of Saddam Hussein. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Do you think that Saddam Hussein should be tried in an international court? 505-7850 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Montgomery, the Nuremberg trials you mentioned before in our conversation have emerged as something of a gold standard, at least kind of an early gold standard for these issues. What exactly did they put in place at Nuremberg? What principles did they put in place that are pertinent today as we witness yesterday the capture of Saddam Hussein?
Well, the basic principle is that violations of human rights can indeed be judged beyond the confines of national sovereignty. The position prior to Nuremberg was, in effect, that if a crime was committed within a country, then only that country could judge it. And to a certain extent, that is still the case. That is to say, a crime committed in the United States cannot normally be judged or prosecuted outside of the United States. Criminal law, in other words, has to do with the place the crime is committed. Now, exceptions to this, of course, exist in that you can extradite. In the case of murder, really serious crimes, one country will extradite the person to the other country, and the problem will be taken care of that way. But at Nuremberg, this notion of limiting criminal responsibility to within a country was seen to be entirely inadequate. It couldn't handle the horrible atrocities that took place under the Nazis during the Second World War. And so Nuremberg established an international tribunal, and then later on with the European Convention on Human Rights and the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, you have standards of human dignity that can be applied everywhere. And where these are violated, where there are, as the term has it, gross and massive violations of human rights, then the perpetrators can be brought before an international tribunal, judged, and sentenced.
Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Car phone callers, first-time callers, and internet callers will obviously get top priority. And if you're listening on the internet and would like to call, if you need to log off in order to make that telephone call, we will let you stay on the line to hear the response to your question or your comment. Craig is up. He's calling from his car. Craig, welcome to Issues Etc.
It's a pleasure to talk with you, Dr. Montgomery. I'm curious if maybe Hussein might be tried for some of his crimes in an international court and some of them in an Iraqi court.
Good question, Craig. Thank you. Dr. Montgomery.
Well, yes, in principle, the difficulty there is to distinguish what crimes would be appropriate only within the framework of the Iraqi situation. You see, the whole country was under Saddam's thumb. The entire legal system was part of Saddam's regime, until the legal system has been cleansed, it would be awkward and difficult, it would seem to me, to hang his crimes onto the pegs of that existing legal system. You could certainly do this to a limited extent. For example, individual murders that he brought about, where he commanded them, or he knew that they were taking place under his orders, that sort of thing. But it seems to me that there would be no way in the world within the Iraqi legal framework to deal with the larger and really important aspects of what he did, namely the genocidic activity, the massive human rights violations that he engaged in, the aggressive war. You know, one of the major accounts against the Nazis at Nuremberg was that they had engaged in aggressive war. Now, there's no way in the world that a national legal system could handle that.
So the essence there is really that no system of an individual country has laws to cover the kind of crimes, some of those crimes, that Saddam Hussein committed as
the
a leader.
Yes, the most serious crimes, you're quite right. And I think with someone like Saddam, you don't want to obscure the really serious areas by dealing with lesser matters. It's often an approach of lawyers to concentrate only on the really essential things, and not to allow the trivial matters to overwhelm them. It is said that a layman fires a shotgun, but a lawyer fires a rifle. He aims carefully at the center of the target and makes sure that he hits that, and doesn't disperse his energies on things that are not as important.
Kurt is calling from his car. Kurt, thank you for waiting. Welcome to Issues Etc. Kurt, welcome. All right, we'll get Kurt back if we can here. Dr. Montgomery.
I hope he didn't lose control of his car.
I hope so. I hope not either. There's another thing that Saddam Hussein is at this particular point, whether he's an enemy combatant or a prisoner of war. He is perhaps a source of information that could spare lives in the future, and that could also enlighten the kind of crimes he was committing. In other words, he is akin to the serial killer who can tell us where the bodies are buried. How do we deal with the issue of Saddam Hussein as a source of information?
The problem there is that if he begins to be cooperative, as some news reports have said that he is, if he begins to be cooperative with the kind of person he is, he will be doing this only in order to make himself look good and to mitigate the kind of punishment that he might receive eventually. I do not believe that we ought to engage in any kind of plea bargaining with a man like this, because I don't think that any information that he has is going to be all that valuable. I mean, there was no clear evidence that he was cooperating with bin Laden and with the terrorist operations along those lines. What he was doing was creating a perfect hell for his own people. And there may be no great caches of nuclear weapons in the country. He may not have been able to manage this. We know already that he would have liked to do this, and there were preparations for the future to do it. But it seems to me that the kind of information that he has available is the sort of thing that's going to be discovered anyway eventually, and that includes the remaining leadership, such as it is, that's engaged in Iraqi terrorism within the country at the moment. Now, of course, we ought to squeeze as much information out of him as we possibly can, but I don't think we should do this through some kind of plea bargaining. It seems to me that playing games with a devil like that is not a good idea at all. In general, I happen to dislike plea bargaining immensely. I know it goes on in the American legal system all the time. In England, in the English legal system, it's regarded as a fairly immoral practice. And is only condoned in situations where, it can result in the clear saving of lives in the future.
Larry is calling from his car. Larry, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yeah, let me ask a brief and probably foolish question. What's the likelihood that this is going to turn into a political and legal circus for who knows how long? Thanks.
Thank you, Larry. What are the possibilities there, Dr. Montgomery?
Well, if it turns into some kind of a circus, that'll not be due to the lawyers or the judges. It'll be due to the media. It's the media that create these circuses. One important difference between American and English law is that in England, the press are not allowed to do anything like the depth reporting of existing cases. Of cases, pending cases, cases that are they're in the bosom of the court, as we say, as goes on in the United States. Over here, at the time of the O.J. Simpson trial, the average Englishman was absolutely appalled at the television coverage of that trial, and they saw how that encouraged people to play to the gallery. So the international tribunals are more aligned with the English practice and the continental practice, and therefore I would imagine that there would be a great deal less television in the courtroom and that sort of thing, and in any case it would be far less obtrusive.
There is a concern, of course, because Slobodan Milosevic, on trial for his crimes, is managing to kind of stretch things out a little bit. If I'm not mistaken, he's trained as a lawyer and therefore is able to kind of make things run very slowly. How likely is that to occur with Saddam Hussein?
I think it's much less likely, owing to the fact that that Saddam is a is a dictator, pundit, and a person with a short fuse. And I don't think, therefore, he would be capable of pulling some of what Milosevic has pulled. But even there, you know, better that there should be an open public trial than to have anyone able to say later on that this was just a vindication of the victor's role and a kangaroo court had taken place. I mean, there are worse things than publicity. I mean, not a lot, but there are some worse things, and one of the worst things is certainly not to have justice appear to be done.
Dr. Montgomery, I hope I don't offend your moral sensibilities by asking you this, but if you were defending Saddam Hussein in an international court, what possible argument, someone will be defending him, what possible arguments can be put forth? What kind of case can be made?
I think the only case would be an insanity defense. That the man had reached such a point of megalomania that he was incapable of knowing the difference between right and wrong, and that therefore the appropriate punishment would be confinement in a psychiatric institution for the remainder of his days.
Do you think a case like that can be demonstrated?
I doubt it very much, because the trouble with trying to make that case would be that Saddam himself would refuse the defense. He would say, as apparently he already has, that he was a tough but firm leader, and he knew exactly what he was doing. And under those circumstances, it would be awfully difficult for his counsel to take any other position. Moreover, it is ultimately the decision of the individual, the client, as to the overall thrust of the defense. It's up to counsel. It's up to the lawyer to determine the way in which the defense is conducted. But he cannot put forth a defense which is directly contrary to what his client wants.
You have said earlier in the conversation that there are other places where we would do well to put an end to the atrocities and the misrule of other leaders in the world. We will be perhaps doing something like this again with someone other than Saddam Hussein. How important is the precedent that we set with this very high-profile case, how he is tried, where he's tried, and how the case is brought for any future action of a similar nature?
Oh, it's tremendously important. Because if justice is seen to be done, and the end result of this is clearly a positive one ethically, and people, even those who dislike the whole idea of the war to begin with, are forced to admit this, then they have a much weaker ground to argue that other humanitarian interventions should not take place.
Now, finally, Dr. Montgomery, this certainly should not be the motivation of civil government, but what kind of inroads can be made in Iraq for spreading the gospel of Jesus Christ now that at least this great step has been taken towards saying Saddam is not coming back?
Well, my understanding is that the provisional government are trying to establish a constitution which is modeled, to some extent at least, on the American Constitution. If that's so, then there would certainly be an equivalent of the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights is, in effect, the substance of the European Convention on Human Rights and the American Convention on Human Rights. So I would certainly imagine that those protections, those civil rights protections, would be included. And among those protections, of course, is the freedom of religion. Now, Muslims do not believe in the freedom of religion. That is to say, they will not allow for proselytizing, as they call it, that is to say, evangelism, to take place within their countries. This is why it's impossible in countries like Iran and the like, Bangladesh and so on, for Christian evangelism to occur. However, if a constitution comes about in Iraq which does guarantee freedom of religion, that is, the right not only to believe as you wish, but to change your religion, if that's present, then that opens the door for Christian faith to be presented, not to go in and dominate the situation, but to be able to go in and present the historic gospel of Jesus Christ. And that's all we want. We don't want to force Christianity or try to force Christianity down the throats of people. If you do that, it's counterproductive. They're not going to become Christians unless they can make a decision on this personally and volitionally. But if that opportunity is provided, then it'll open wonderful doors in that country, because in countries where it's impossible for the gospel to be heard, invariably this has the most negative consequence on the entire lifestyle.
Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, thank you so much for being our guest.
You're most welcome. Always a pleasure.
Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is Professor Emeritus at the University of Luton in England. He's a French advocate, barrister at law in England and Wales, and a member of the Bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He serves as Distinguished Professor of Apologetics and the History of Christian Thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana. He has authored and edited over 50 books, including Christians in the Public Square. He is also, by the way, the director of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, which is held annually in Strasbourg, France. Now, if you want information on this academy, call our resource line, 1-800-737-0172. We'll send you a free information brochure on the academy, 1-800-737-0172, or check it out on our website, issuesetc.org. issuesetc.org. 3 weeks left in year 2003, and as we're approaching the end of this year, I would like you to consider supporting Issues Etc. It's talk radio for the thinking Christian. It's easy to react. It's easy to jump to conclusions. It's more difficult to think, but far more fruitful, especially for the Christian. Issues Etc. is talk radio for the thinking Christian, and I would like you to support it as we approach the end of 2003 by becoming a monthly contributor or by making a year-end tax-deductible gift to Issues Etc. Now, where else on Christian radio are you going to hear someone with the expertise, the credentials, and the ideas of Dr. John Warwick Montgomery? Now, to find out how you can become an Issues Etc. confessor, apologist, or reformer, you can go to our website, issuesetc.org, and click on the What's New section. Or you can also see page 8 of the latest Issues Etc. journal. Now, if you'd like to support this worldwide outreach of Issues Etc., you can do so by check. Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Or you can also donate by credit card at 1-800-737-0172. We'll be right back with Congressman John Chimkins.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.